Jack wants you to talk about Will. And Bert is concerned with faith and Will. I wonder if you'd like to restate that problem again, Jack, isn't there?
Well, modern psychologists have pretty well done away with Will. Behaviourists, Freudians and so forth, according to them, you only react to the latest stimulus or the greatest stimulus. Now, if you go back 40 odd years, you used to see books about Will. Now, that sort of Will goes back to what I was still in my mind last week. That sort of Will was, I would think, intellectual Will, such as, well, I won't smoke anymore. Now, when you speak of Will, it's a different sort of Will, a sort of animal Will, something that has its own direction. I'm puzzled there between the conscious and unconscious Will, the direction of the Will.
Can you formulate your question at the same time, Ben?
I would like to know what the relationship, if there is any relationship between faith and will. Because when you have faith in a thing, I take it that you are willing in a certain direction. When you lose faith in a thing, you stop willing in a certain direction. Is that correct?
Well, if you don't define what will is and what faith is, and to say you lose one and the other, unknown, undefined, doesn't help, does it?
In other words, I would
take two unknowns and define them in such a way that when you lose one, you lose the other, and you don't know what either of them is, isn't very helpful.
No, well, I see the person in the one case reacting to stimulus. That's just reaction to stimulus. But I'm thinking in terms of the man of honour that makes up his mind what direction he's going to go in. Something has to keep him in that direction, which I think is perhaps faith. That constant flow of energy in that direction, I wonder if that's faith. And if he loses faith, something happens.
If we don't define what it is he's lost, we won't be any wiser when he's lost it. We won't know what it is we're trying to find. Now, probably the best definition of faith is St. Paul's definition. He says faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. So let's say substance. Faith is a substance of things hoped for. That's three ideas we have. Substance, things, hope. Faith is that, the substance of the thing you hope to get. So now we'll do a drawing in which we have objectivity, namely the thing in the middle here. Substance is that which is standing underneath, isn't it? Now a thing, like the thing I'm holding in my hand, means shade dark, to mean matter. There's the realm of things, and underneath it, according to Paul's definition, is faith. And remember the diagram we did of the sea before? We did a straight diagram and then a round one. Well, we can't understand this one unless we make an equivalent diagram again in the form of a circle. So we'll make one here. And we're going to put the substance inside here this time. That's the substance. And we're going to put the things here, round it, and we're going to put the hope outside that. Now you can tell by this P in hope that it refers to particulars. And this H is spirit. So whole pay is the same thing as having an image of a particular in consciousness. So we can write consciousness because spirit is conscious. We can write consciousness there, and we can write the particular which is in consciousness there. Hope for particulars, consciousness for a particular, means that the consciousness is precipitating itself like this, you see, onto its centre. What we call desire for a thing, when we wish to be rude about it or moral, we call covetousness. Covering. Trying to enclose it in your being. Now hope always aims at possessing some thing. So the thing is then internal to the hope. Hope is like the field surrounding the thing, but underneath the thing is the substance, which is called faith. Now, that same thing which is called faith is also spirit. Faith is not an attitude of mind. That is hope. Faith is that which is underneath the thing itself, not on top of it. Hope we are conscious of. The thing we are conscious of, I'm conscious of this thing. But internal to that thing, there is spirit, which when we consider it as substantially able to become a thing, we call it faith. And we do so because the word faith is really the word path with an I put into it. Faith is path-making energy or spirit. This is why the faith can move mountains, it can do anything, providing you allow it to mobilize itself. Faith is energy. It is not simply an intellectual concept with no existence. It is real spirit, which is fundamental or substantial to the whole universe of things. We'll see how this is related to will in a moment. First, we have to see that spirit is the substance of the universe. It is that which is underneath all things, in terms of science, underneath that material object there are electrical charges. What those charges are, science does not know. It knows how to do operations with them. It does not know what they are, other than that they are causes of the effects that science studies. Faith is path-making energy welling up from your middle, if you find it. And you can find it only by not allowing an external stimulus to impose on you. If your consciousness is drawn out to the stimulus, then you are reactive, you are driven towards it, and you can't get down to the substance. This hope zone in this diagram is to introvert itself, to get the faith which is actually below the thing. And in order to see why this works, to get this thing going the right way around, isn't it? Now we're going to do a little portion of this, take it out and make a diagram like this one again, and we're going to write spirit here. If you like, you can have the Sanskrit term for it in Indian metaphysics, because in general it helps to free your mind from certain associations of the word spirit. If you talk about spirituality with your usual education, you tend to start thinking about churchianity, and that blinds you to the real significance of it. We can derive the real significance by looking at the peary in there. This thing is originally a serpent, which symbolizes this intelligent energy. Serpent means free thought. This Pili is the formal aspect, and this it at the end is the establishment. So we're going to put that and say this is the substance, spirit. In Sanskrit, we would say that is Atman. And this art at the beginning is the root of eat. So it is the man-eater. Shakespeare says the ultimate is universal appetite, which eats up itself. This is the man-eater, spirit. Now, out of the eater came forth meat. This is the eater. And he makes for himself the zone of things. Remember, this is a little section taken out of this circular diagram. This is the zone of things. And the things are the cause of the external stimulus, because each thing has external to it other things whose vibrations impinge upon it and cause reactions. So in the realm of things, we have mutual interference by things. And I put X on there. It's made of two arrowheads, one there and one there. So that X means two forces in opposition. That's why the Andrew cross, which is this X form, is called the rotating or whirling cross, because rotation occurs from forces in opposition. And in the realm of things, there is this continuous mutual interference which stops the consciousness, which is this very spirit, from being pure. And that consciousness is absolute. There is nothing it doesn't know. There is no problem that is not already solved in it. But here is the realm of physical bodies, and up here we're going to draw the realm of individual minds. And down here is the absolute spirit, which knows all, the centre of this diagram and the lower stratum of this diagram. At the top are individual minds, we'll call them I mind for short, and there is one mind for every form that is circumscribed. That means if you have a separate form, like Bert's form is separate from Jack's form, then there are two minds, because mind means to count, and counting is no more than the interference of one being by another being's vibrations. The D in mind is simply the division that occurs between those two rotation centres. Every individual is a complex system of rotations, and the mutual interference of those two is, for each of them, the world of stimulation, which he calls the objective world. When he looks inside, he calls it subjective, because he is the subject, the knower. What comes from his perimeter, he says, is caused by an object. So, in the realm of minds, the individuation is a product of the separate bodies in the thing world. And the absolute non-plurality principle underneath is the spirit, or Atman. Now, the word for individual mind-body is jiva. You can see that this G is the same thing as, this looks remarkably like Jehovah, and the Hebrew name, which is the same as this Sanskrit name, means he who goes, the prime mover. When we put the vowel in here, I, that means individual. So Jiva means he, individual, goes. So we say that the individual, the Jiva and the Atman, differ only in this, that the jiva is circumscribed and the Atman is not. If there is a circle, that is in the realm of jiva. Rub out the circle and it is spirit. So if we take one of the titles of Gautama Buddha, which is the Tathagata, this word gata in Sanskrit is our word jiva. You see? So if I draw a gem, nice little gem jar, now there's air outside here and air in the jar, and the air is not separated outside the jar and inside the jar, but outside the jar it is called spirit, and inside it is called soul, because we said soul means circumscribed. So when we're considering this problem of what faith is spirit itself. Faith is a peculiar creative movement of the absolute towards specific ends. This is why when we are asked to have faith in things, it is said, whatsoever you ask in my name, believing you shall receive. Now, in my name means don't ask for something that's inherently self-contradictory, because you can't have it. And that is the test of truth. The great non-dualistic test of truth is this. If a thing is contradicted by two modes of consciousness, it cannot be true. So if we get a bowl of water in a glass bowl and we put a knife in it, there's the handle, there's the blade, it appears that the blade is bent from the handle when you put it in the knife. Now this is contradicted by the sense of touch, which assures you that the blade is in a continuous line with the handle. So there's contradiction between the message to the eye and the message of the finger. And when the senses contradict each other, it cannot be true. And if all your senses do not contradict each other, what they say is true. So non-contradiction is the test of truth. Now, faith itself, we said, was path-making energy. That energy means in work. And it is the spirit which works. And when it works internally, that is circumscribedly, in circumscribing itself, we change its name and call it energy in working. As if it goes into that jar and spins round inside, during the spinning round inside the jar, the air is called energy. It is in work. So when we remember that faith means path-making energy, and path-making is an idea of a force applying itself in a situation, we can then tie it up with what will means. If we draw a gradient going down and we put a ball on the edge of it with the gravity centre of that ball carrying it down, it will rest on the edge of that gradient. There's our flat surface, there's a gradient. Now if we push the ball very carefully with a finger here till the ball gets here and here, until more than half of it is over the edge, it will start to roll. Now, the little push, the last push there, that initiates that motion which places the ball under the influence of gravity, we call will. So we only use the word will at the point when we initiate a motion. So every established motion we do not call will. We say that the after motion is called desire. Now, modern psychology has got this the wrong way round, as we'll see in a moment when we come to consider the history of psychology. Will is a point of initiation of the change. Desire is the after motion, viewed psychologically. Because if something is initiated, it always feels to the person moving that he desires to move. But desire means from the Father. And Father means generative power. So the Father is the will. So we can say Father, this is the same thing as the Trinity again, equals will. Son equals idea. And the HG, Holy Ghost or Spirit, and I oop. Is the operation or motion. So we have an idea that if we push this ball to the edge, it will begin to roll. That idea is the Son which illuminates us in the act. We have a will which is the Father or generative force, and then an operation. And this is desire from the Father once the inclination is reached. This is an incline. Psychologically, what we call an inclination means no more than that there is a gradient in the nervous system. The nerves are thick near centre, and as they go away, they get thinner and thinner. There's a gradient there. And the nervous fluid stored in centres tends to run down, just like the sap tends to run from the trunk through the branches into the twigs. So in the nervous system, the nervous energy goes from certain centres down those nerves into the action world with the physical body. And we must not use the word will except for the point of initiation. Now we'll go and do the history of psychology and see just why there has arisen, not confusion in the minds of real psychologists, but in a lot of their followers. You know that psyche is the Greek for soul, isn't it? So, really, psychology means logos, or rationalization about the soul. And once upon a time, psychology meant the study of the soul. But after a time, scientific men said, this is about the time of the Renaissance in Europe, about the 14th century in Italy, spreading into Germany and England in about the 16th. They said, let us not believe anything unless we can get at it with our physical senses. So, like the Marxists say, let me get my hands on the soul and I will believe it. Now it's obvious that if the psyche is what it is defined to be by the ancients, you cannot get your physical hands on it. Because the psyche is sentiency itself. You see, sentience is feeling. It is the field, consciousness. We'll put the field con in there for short. So the psyche, when we circumscribe spirit, which itself is pure sentiency, in the act of circumscribing it, that's the K in there, the circumscription, makes a unific being which feels itself. So that the old psychology was a science of why we feel what we feel. And this was the question, why do we feel what we feel? Later on, in behaviorism, it becomes how do things cause action? The question is changed. But first of all, it starts with psychology, the science of the soul. Then they change in the Renaissance when they are talking in terms of the mind applied in physical experiments. They say that the psyche, we'll write it again, equals the mind. Because the mind is the coordinator of the five senses. And they have committed themselves to believe only what the five senses tell them. And the five senses cannot tell them about the field which surrounds the body. And therefore, psychology became, we'll say, from the 14th century, became the science of the mind, that is, of the coordinator of the five senses. So during this period, all psychology is concerned with the counting processes of the counting mechanism, because mind is counting mechanism. So anciently, psychology meant the science of why we feel what we feel. Then it came to mean the science of the mechanics of mental processes, how counting adds up. Then they discovered that this required you to introvert your attention, which required terrific concentration and self-discipline. Now, the funny thing about most scientists is that they lack self-discipline, and they therefore find it much easier to discipline the external world in a laboratory experiment. So then the psyche becomes a non-entity, you see. It becomes a non-entity for them, because they said, we're going to study bodies in their relations. And this we call mechanistic behaviorism, of which the leading exponent in New York is Watson, and this reduces the whole being to a system of reflexes, of which the purest type is illustrated if I bang the table and that thing bounces. That's the pure type of a reflex, the reflex of a so-called inanimate object. We can actually prove, if we care to concentrate very hard, we can prove that the fact that that table does have elasticity and bounces when we thump it proves that it's alive. But we'll reserve that for another occasion. Meanwhile, we've got three kinds of psychology. The ancient view that it is concerned with why the feeler, the sentiency, does what it does. That's the ancient psychology. Then from the Renaissance it becomes the science of the mind. That is the coordinator of the five senses. And then in the 19th century they've got nowhere with that because it requires self-discipline and is very, very hard to do. It becomes easier to get a lot of bobs, like dogs and things, and cut pieces off them and listen to what they say, stimulate their salivation mechanism with meat and bell ringing and so on, and condition the reflexes. This is much easier than sitting in a chair thinking without falling asleep. And as all things tend to take the line of least resistance, there is a spontaneous movement in the universe to finish up in a materialistic analysis before it has to turn back. So there's a drive from spirit through soul, through mind, into body. And let's look at this natural hierarchy. This time I'm going to put spirit at the top now as most important. It is still substantial. But if you look in your dictionary, you will find that the prefix sub and super is identical. A thing can be sub or super according to point of view. Because if we take this, a man living in Mucky Manchester here, and there's London, says I'm going up to the metropolis because it is important. But if he's a very rich man, he may go every week by airplane by going up in the air, which is away from the centre. So if that is the centre of the earth, we call it down. But if we wanted to get something there, supposing we found a gold mine there, we would say we're going up for the gold. Up means always urge to the point. UP is your urge to get to a point. So up means important. So we put the spirit at the top now because we are evolving towards it. People that are not evolving towards spirit but are delving into it are not interested in spirit. Perhaps we say, oh, it doesn't spirit. And we mean it's not important. So we've got spirit there. And first thing is to create soul, so we have soul, and in our circular diagram the mind is simply the division of the soul by the five sense structures inside. So we'll write the mind here, and we'll put five little marks for our five senses, and we'll put five little dots for the five objects. And we've got spirit becoming soul, a counting process going on in the soul called mind, the supplying of data to the mind through five different tools, and a substratum now, really underneath, from the point of view of importance to us, but not to businessmen, is passivity itself. Now this spirit, you notice, is pata. It's your father. You notice that this word, P-I-T-R-I, Pitri, is Sanskrit for father. And the one down below is mother, the mater. So the father is up there and the mother's down there, and between the two all generation occurs. This is tremendously important because it's the meaning of those two pigeons flying in front of the car. The father and the mother, spirit and matter, beget the world between them. And you can see which mostly belongs to your mother and which to your father by this diagram. Belonging to your mother are the five senses, which derive their information from the material world, and therefore your mother is more materialistic than your father. She must be, because she bears the children. She has to provide the nourishment. If she did not concentrate on the material world, she would not be able to accrete energies to secrete food to give to her children. And this we call the tacit conspiracy, the secret silent conspiracy from the origins of the universe, where without speaking, there has been a polarization of the absolute as father, mother, spirit, matter. And on the father side occurs individuation, that circumscription, which is all the same thing with form. We'll call it the circus, and it's just simply going round, and that is form, the Greek for which is idea. So your father, the male side of you, is concerned with ideas, with forms, with definitions. Your mother's side is concerned with physical generation, security in the physical world, and prime urge towards drawing more spirit in. So there's a definite movement in women. Actually, if you could photograph the field of a woman, you photographers, with the appropriate screens, you will find that every potential mother is the center of a vortex, like this. That women are actually doing this all the time. They are pulling on men, generally. They pull on masculinity, whatever it is. And as the little circumscribed creatures call men, you see, come within the field, they tend, quite unconsciously, to move in. And they're being driven between these two forces. And the force that's drawn in is only to be thrown out again as a child. And if they are both unconscious of the process, we say they are on the pitriyama, or on the way, yana means way, of their ancestors. They are generating. There's a diagram very useful here. We go round, in, out, all the way around the circle, you see? Just like this. Now, on the outgo, we call it male. On the ingo, we call it female, in the spiritual world. But in the material world, if I put on the outgo there Mars, which is the biological sign of a male, and Venus here, which is the biological sign of a female, then in the spiritual world, that is our diagram, and in the material world, the mater world, your mother's world, the same diagram is represented with the outgoing as female. We'll put Venus on there, and the ingoing as male. The reason is this: the driving in energy into matter is called positive because it posits, it posits form. This is like spermatic energy. But the expansive energies, which make an ovum in a woman much bigger than a sperm in a man, those we call negative energies because they are apparently passive in the material world. Thus an egg inside a woman hasn't got legs and it hasn't got a tail. It is shuffled along the fallopian tube out to the Garden of Eden. You see? Incidentally, all these anatomical terms are designed deliberately from the beginning so that inside your body you have a metaphysical educational device. That egg comes down the fallopian tube, shuffled along by little processes inside it, and it is in the material world passive. But when it goes to its uterine bed, there's a colossal field around it, a gradient. And this gradient is in effect such that anybody in it which has any sentiency and positivity will start moving towards it. And it appears as an electrical, a chemical gradient. So that in effect, if we put lactic acid behind a sperm, that will start swimming the other way. And this is a precipitant of the spiritual activity which invisibly surrounds that egg. So that we must look at those two diagrams and think, in the spiritual world, that which is going out, flying out towards freedom, like men trying to get out of a house on Saturday night, that's called male. And the thing trying to drag them into the house on precisely that same night is called female. Whereas in the material world, it appears that the energy of outflying is female because it's sending out messages to see where hubby is. And driving him from his point of enjoyment there by a peculiar sentence called a feeling of discomfort. I'm sure she's thinking about me. And he then goes home. And this process is fundamentally, tremendously important because it runs right through the universe. This is the tacit conspiracy that the absolute, which is beyond duality, polarizes itself without speaking because the absolute does not speak. That's why we say it's a tacit conspiracy. It doesn't speak because there's a K in speak and the absolute is unlimited. And K means limitation. So, the absolute has polarized itself without mentioning it. Old Chinese saying says, don't mention it. See? And the result is that there appears in the individual realm an apparent bias. And the bias is opposite on the inside and the out. Inside you are a spiritual being, outside you are a material being. Inside your will to freedom is male, and your will to introversion is female. If the introversion feeling reduces you to passivity, we call it listening to God. Be still and know that I am God. And then we say that the soul is essentially a woman relative to God. So all souls are female to God. That is to say, female means relatively passive. And in the material world, the opposite holds. So now we have faith as our substratum spirit, path-making energy, the point of initiation as will. And this same will is the father energy, or spirit again, considered only at the point of initiation, and after initiation, when the thing has started rolling, it is called desire. Now, in the case... Can we have another call, please? In the case of the analysis we've done, we've seen a very simple and logical demonstration of the structure of the world, and I'll now show you the theoretical side of yoga. Yoga is the practical side, and Samkhya is the theoretical side of a science. We shouldn't talk about yoga as theory. Yoga is practice. And Samkhya is its theoretical basis. Now, here's the word Samkhya, S-A-M, which means seed, K-H-Y-M. Now, this K means a closure or lock, or finiting, a limitation. Nya means affirmation. Seed, closure, affirmation. Samkhya is said to mean enumeration of the categories. Now we're going to draw a line down the middle, and a line at the top, and this is again an abstract of a circular diagram, and outside it we're going to put the absolute, beyond the duality. Samkhya means the enumeration of the categories, and it's the theoretical side of yoga. Now, on this side, we're going to put the Purusha, Purusha, P-U-R-U-S-H-A, which means city dweller. Thank you. And this is the self. This is the self. On the observer. Now, this is a deliberate abstraction because we can never find a self which is an observer on its own, because in order to perceive there must be an object. So we've deliberately drawn there a line down the centre and put on one side of it Purusha for we shall be observer, the self, the subject, not the object. This means the subject grammatically. He who does the thing in a sentence. But all he does is observe. He doesn't do anything else. So you have in you consciousness which never does anything. But when it looks at things, things change. But it does not change them. If you look at two ideas and one is rubbish and the other is not, you find that the one that's not rubbish doesn't contradict itself, and the one that does contradict itself contradicts itself. Both of them in consciousness. Like we said about the knife appearing to be bent in the water. All the self or observer or subject does is simply see that a thing either contradicts itself or it doesn't. In this sense we say that the consciousness cannot make a mistake. When that knife appears bent to the eye is telling the truth about it, saying it appears bent. And when the finger finds that it's straight, the finger is telling the truth about saying it feels straight. The contradiction between the two has to be resolved. So on this side we're at Purusha, the self, the observer, the subject, and we write nothing else. And on the other side we write Prakriti. Now Kriti, Pra is the same thing as the prefix pre before, and Kriti is the root kra, to create. So this Prakriti means matter, that which is necessary for creation. If we don't have any clay, we cannot make a model. So Prakriti is like the clay. And the first thing it evolves is a sphere, which is called Buddhi. Buddhi. We should pronounce these H's, they're very important. If you say Lucky Buddhas, it's not quite the same meaning. Buddhi means a sphere or a house with formal divisions within it, causing spiritual perception of particulars. So we say of Buddhi, it means the determinative faculty. Determinative, you might remember, faculty. And in Europe, we would call it the intellect. It is said to determine. If you give it a banana, it says that's not an orange, it's a banana. It determines, and what you give it is what it is and not what it is not. It doesn't do anything else, because it is now made of matter, which is fundamentally spirit, but made quiescent, passive, to a stimulus from outside. So it's now a sphere of plastic substance, like clay, waiting to be modelled. And the modelling is going to come from the absolute, all the way through the matter, and it's going to be observed by the self. And then down here comes manas, which is mind, the counting device, and this breaks into five internal organs, five internals. An internal organ we have in the ocular centre for the eyes, at the back of the head. There's a centre to which the messages from your external organs are carried. You've got a centre for smelling in your nose, and the correspondent one in the brain. For each of your five senses, you have an external organ that receives the stimulus from outside, and an internal corresponding organ. And the organ inside, we call the subtle organ, the internal organ, and we can call it subtle, it is still matter, it is very fine matter, and so far, material science has not suspected its existence, because it is much finer than electronic energy. And these five internal organs, they are not the brain matter itself, of the gross brain, they are the field which precipitated that brain. Any old error isn't good enough. You see, you could say, I got up on Tuesday morning and I found I'd parted my hair about 1/16 of an inch to the left of my usual position. Well, it's not good enough, is it? It's not a good error, that.
We've got to look for good ones.
Good errors, yes. Error only means running away, you know. Running away from that universal into particulars. That's the drift from the universal to the particular. And you'll get carried into particular errors, which are not worth mentioning unless you start the back flowing, the salmon. Don't be a twig flowing down the stream, be a salmon going up the stream. Find bigger and better errors. Like a big error, like robbing a bank of £250,000 and getting away with it. You see, that's a big error. If you don't get caught, it's a very big error. Because you'll be worried all your life with your debt to society. You'll have to be knighted before you feel at ease about it.
I find that rather good of a girl,
perhaps,
to tell them that they
weren't
good enough
for
that particular crime. How
yeah.
They could have done it better.
It's a wonderful method, that. Because there's nothing more annoying to the egoically stressed person who's secretly cherishing an error to be told that that error is nothing. Mm-hmm. It's the kind of error that a 14-year-old should be ashamed of. Of such an error, I should be ashamed when I was 5.
It's
a rather smart now, isn't it? Well, that means we've got to run away a bit further first. And then start coming back.
You try and get back, and fantasy will arise in you. This is the important thing, because you don't know really your next step until you try to get back and fail. The form of your failure in moving towards the universal gives you the key to the kind of error that you must commit next. Fantasy always arises when you try to control yourself. The form of it is indicative of what you must do next. Remember, fantasy has two aspects, positive and negative. Fantasia is Greek for imagination. And there is universal imagination, universal. The big error stops you doing the type action which it represents. The little error doesn't.
That sounds like the error has to be big enough to saturate you
then. That's right. It's entirely a matter of saturation of motion.
Yes.
You see, if we take this concept, the soul is generated by the spirit rotating, and then there appears a sort of lazy motion in it, you see. Now, as long as there is room for more motion, we say that's unsaturated. But when we keep going backwards and forwards like this, until we haven't got any more plain paper to draw on, and the marks of the pencil represent force, patience, yes, drawing of patience. When the paper is completely covered up, it is equivalent to the soul being blocked with form, saturated. And it says, so I'm blocked. Now the soul didn't start by being blocked, it started by being innocent, free. And that innocence was precisely that which enabled it to be subjected to a stimulus from outside which informs it. If it were not innocent, it could not become ignorant. The first stimulus convinces it that it doesn't know everything. So innocence, which is unaware that it doesn't know, becomes ignorance after the stimulus hits it. And when you've saturated yourself with experience, till you really can't think of another type of crime that could possibly be done by you, your education is finished. But don't go for the petty crimes. They're no good. They don't help.
Could it be said that Lucifer did the one big error which saturated him completely.
Completely in one act.
In one, yes. He denied, really, didn't he?
Yes, and he denied fully because he generated a gross material world.
Mm.
That's the term of action. So he can go back immediately.
Yes.
This saturation is all on the emotional
plane. On the emotional and the rational and the actual. The three planes are saturated simultaneously.
What did he say about the return of Lucifer? Did we go back immediately?
Yes.
That doesn't mean that he stopped doing it. It means that he realised what he was doing. But he was confirmed in it because if he hadn't have continued to do it, the educational device of the gross material world would have ceased to exist.
Well, is it better to kill 1,000 people rather than one, like the man of the
hour? It isn't the number of people involved.
But that doesn't make it a bigger error, does it? Because he kills 1,000.
It isn't the number. It isn't that kind of magnitude. It's got to do with the emotional reactions in that person and his ideas of magnitude. One man may think, like I might think, if you blow up 100 million men at once, each man is actually so profoundly egotistic that he will only be feeling his own pain. So it's no bigger than killing one man. But to another fellow who thinks that it makes it big to kill a dozen, and thinks that a man that has 5 wives and cuts them all up in the bath and lets them go down the plug hole is worse than a man with only 1 wife who hits it on a Friday. You see, his concepts of magnitude are not right. Nevertheless, the lesson is to him. All lessons are to existential individuals. They're not to hypothetical individuals. They're to existential individuals.
Well, why does ancestral memory come in? None of us here have experienced murdering somebody, but our ancestors may have done.
You have actually experienced in yourself the memory of tendencies in ancestors to do that, and even actual murders done by ancestors that have been done appear in us as instincts to aggress, which are inhibited by tradition. Because we've all got those instincts. Even a little bit of bad temper is the beginning of a murder. It just happens that through the weight of tradition, it is stopped. There's no difference in kind between losing your temper and murdering somebody. It's only a matter of degree. How much energy is let loose into the pattern? When Christ said, if you call a man a rogue, he may take you to the council. If you call him a fool, you are in danger of hell fire, because if you call him a rogue, he can sue you. Defamation of character. If you call him a fool, you've said that he is not a reasonable being. Therefore, if he acts irrationally, it's only the logical result of what you've said. And he therefore, Christ said, be ye not angry, because this anger is the root of murder. It establishes a line of least resistance. If you say to a man you're a fool, you're struck at the very root of his being. People don't like being called fools in a serious tone, do they? This anger, no matter how much you've got of it or how little, is rooted in the very same thing that murders people and always did murder people. And there's nobody alive today who is not possessed of an ancestor, at least one, namely Cain, who was a murderer. And anger is only that first step towards murder. And without it's inhibited by fear of the police, by fear of opinion of the people, of neighbours, of people we're fond of and so on. It is inhibited, but it is there.
And it's
anger is spiritual murder. That it gets inhibited before it gets in the gross world doesn't alter the fact that it is murder. And that it actually murders portions of the soul of the being it's directed towards.
Well, is it better then to go on your ancestral memory than to commit the error yourself?
Well, the thing is to understand it. You see, if you can understand what you are being angry about, you will discover that 90 times out of 100, that anger is not your individual anger, it is ancestral anger. And then you can say, well, I understand this particular lesson of anger and what it does and how it leads ultimately to murder. And that I know the lesson of murder because I've already had that ancestrally. So I don't need to murder anybody now because I've murdered so many people in the past. Just being repetition of an error. In fact, there's nothing brilliant about it, is there, to murder anybody today. We've got so many murders, historically, that it's no longer interesting. So what we do is understand what this impulse is and ask ourselves whether ourselves or our ancestors, who are ourselves before us in history, have committed this error, and if they have, then we don't need to do it.
Well, the atom bomb is doing it for us in a way.
That particular error shook a lot of people in the world and reminded them that they were tending to commit unnecessary errors. The whole thing is, if you can manage never to commit the same error twice, you save a lot of time. Because most people go on committing the same errors and petty, niggling little errors every day of their lives in the same way, with exactly the same pattern, sometimes the same words.
When you say that you have temper towards someone, you actually destroy some part of their soul.
Oh, yes. It's energy you're releasing, not only in the gross material world. You're releasing energy which is attacking that point. You see, and if that other person were absolutely free, you would have no effect on him. And the energy would return immediately to you. That's called heaping coals of fire on the head. But if that person is in an individuated state of identification, he must be harmed by that anger, because he's identified with the soul. And therefore, he's opaque. Therefore, he can't let it go through to infinity. It hits its target.
Is that why the same truth hurts? Is that what it comes in?
Yes, well, of course, truth is universal form, and individual beings who are deficient in that universal knowledge are clinging to errors. And the truth unseats the error with which the person is identified, and the person always feels that they're being robbed or wounded by the insertion of this truth. And they are being robbed and wounded by that truth. Therefore, it says in the book, sorrow must come, meaning in the world of individuated beings, and woe to him by whom. Because if you don't speak the truth, there's going to be trouble, and if you do, there's going to be trouble. You see, if you don't speak the truth to yourself, then you falsify the record in your own mind and prolong your own agony. If you do speak the truth and somebody hears you, well, then you're upsetting the other person and he holds you responsible for saying it.
When some of the girls cross me, I suppose they shouldn't, this is nowadays, and I look at them as I was on the ground, and if they took one step, I would. But in fact, I don't, because I don't take that step, because I look at them like that. Well, that stops them, as nothing else would stop them. What's it going on me?
It's bad on you. There is another way of stopping them. The way that you're doing it at the moment is by compacting yourself,
yeah,
and ideating a concept of aggression, which is immediate,
yeah,
and it does you harm.
Yeah.
That's the price you pay for being at that level. There's a lower level when they get away with it.
Don't you think ultimately it
doesn't know anything
good?
No. Good to individuals can only come to relative harm.
Mm.
Is it a question of level of being?
Yeah.
Above this method of sudden compaction, which produces an immediate effect, there is another kind of surety, where you picture yourself in the absolute and say that the universal has got everything within it. And instead of identifying it with your individuality as the point of aggression, you identify the point of aggression with the universe. Because God is not mocked. And you actually think internally, there is a law, you know. They don't know what you're thinking.
Mm.
You're thinking, there is a law, you know.
Mm.
They're thinking, she's going to hit me in a minute.
Mm.
That's their business.
Mm.
You see, you pass it right back.
Mm.
Out of the zone of the individual.
Maybe I've never done that, but sometimes it seems to me that I have done that, and it's all right. And other times, I don't feel that would be all right, and I have to do the other thing.
It's a fall. There's a little bit of fear still there if you have to tell yourself that you're going to aggress. As a matter of fact, I had to do last night in a certain situation what appeared like individual aggression, and I had no intention of doing it at all.
Mm.
All I did was invoke the law.
But in fact, I don't think that I would ever aggress physically, violently, or have any intention of doing it, but I sound as though I would.
And I feel as though I would, but I'm sure and certain that I never would.
Now, if you feel as an individual,
yes,
then you would.
Mm.
You put an individual form in you, and the energy is there.
Yes.
If at that moment that girl did something, egotism would appear in you,
mm,
and it would become imperative to establish your egoic value in front of her because you'd committed yourself.
I see.
Whereas in the other case, it doesn't matter if they disobey you, because they're not obeying you in any case.
No.
It may be that for some universal reason they've got to say, "Oh, push, touch, and twaddle," and run out of the door.
Uh-huh.
You see, and a bucket of whitewash fall on them at that moment,
because
you didn't put there.
Mm.
It's this absolute belief that universal law will do it, and all you're doing is thinking about that law, and the other person, being at a low level, misinterprets it as individual aggression, which you have no intention of doing. You do it often very little children. You've no intention of grinding them into ground. I mean, I said to a little boy the other day, he was behaving very, very badly, and I said, "Would you like to put to a mincer and turn into sausages?" And he said, "No." I didn't say anything else. I didn't think I was going to put him to a mincer. But that is a possibility. And metaphysically.
And I know it works, but I didn't think it would work with, say, adults or near adults.
Oh, yes, it would, because they're not adults. They're not adults.
Yeah.
Adult means to the ultimate.
Mm.
They're nowhere near that.
Oh, no,
they're babies.
I know that he wants
they're immature,
but
they're not adults.
I thought that would have.
Oh, yes, it will. You see, the thing that terrifies them is the unknown.
Mm.
And there's something much more unknown to them than your individuality.
Oh, yes.
Than the universal. If you identify with the universal and then focus it on them, with an absolute conviction in you that there is a law, karma, shiksal, kismat, you see, fate is about to descend on you. Well, they think, "Good gracious, does she know somebody that I don't know about?" Anything else, maybe she'll write to my boyfriend. You see, the whole mind is staggered. When you're absolutely sure in that sense, the mind staggers and searches for loopholes. It looks for its own deficiencies and it finds them, and it's quite sure you've discovered some of them.
Yes.
What did you say there? That people actually defeat themselves.
Right.
No.
Right.
So
you
think, start thinking
about
it. Well, all defeat is self defeat ultimately.
Mm.
You know, when you're playing chess, you never win a game. It's the other fellow who loses it. Because the game of chess has rules. The man who keeps to the rules doesn't win, it's the rule that wins. The other fellow who loses didn't keep to the rules. So the game is always lost, it's never won. And the same in a battle. There's a certain strategy which will work in that field. The fellow who doesn't do it loses. The other fellow is called a winner. But you know, winner gives you a clue, because W is the same thing as will, urge, inner. The inner urge wins. The outer urge loses. Because it's loose. The compact man, the introverted man who knows what he's doing, is a winner. He's a will inner. The loser is a loose will, flopping out and the stimulus is hitting him.
Winning is also concerned with integration as well.
You know, the funny thing about language is this. It doesn't matter what language you take, because if you translate from one to another, you find the same ideas viewed from different aspects, the phonetic values of which are identical when pushed back into the roots of all the languages, because they have one root. And this fundamental root language is such that all the forms in it correspond with the universal forms which are objectified in the material world. So there's an exact correspondence between material things and phonetic values. And if you use the right term in the right situation, understanding arises. If you use the wrong term, you will deceive yourself.
You know, it's going to be a difficulty now until you know that's keen.
That key is a system so simple that if you give it to somebody, they cannot understand what it means. Just like the word om, you see, with the mouth closed. That's what it's about. On one occasion, one of our noble lords was approached by a man who'd been digging hysterically into the secrets of masonry, and he said to him, "I've discovered the secrets of Masonic initiations." And this gentleman said, And this man immediately went away and wrote a book saying that Lord so-and-so had been unable to reply to this challenge. See the different levels.
He had replied,
he had replied, but the other fellow didn't understand the reply. You see, if we close the mouth, we've made a sphere which contains within itself all forms whatever, so that every letter that you can pronounce is pronounced inside that closed mouth, only simultaneously. If we serialize it, we get Moses backwards with a leakage. That's why Moses is called the Great Initiate, because he's the Om reverse leaking. Because that's, at the end, means issue. Things were an issue, more issue. In Hebrew, say Moshe. Taken out of the waters, coming out of materiality. He's a Great Initiate. He kept his mouth shut and people said, "Why are you not speaking?" He went about for a long time with his mouth shut, so everybody began to follow him and said, "Why are you not speaking? We know you can speak, we remember when you used to speak. Why not now?" Because people are curious about a secret. And when he got enough inertia in the people following him, he turned around and said, "The reason I have not spoken is because you were not fit to hear. However, I have considered and I have drawn upon these tablets some rules." Well, unfortunately, he made them of stone, didn't he? And when he came down, they were worshipping a calf. You know what calf love is, don't you? It's the kind that young boys have when they see a well-figured lady and they get mixed up between a girlfriend and their mother. Isn't it? They'd come out of Egypt, the luscious land of sensuous experience. They wanted to get back because it was so lovely. So he made some tablets, and he made them of stone. And when he came down and saw them, he got so mad at them wanting to go back to Mother Egypt, he threw the tablets down and broke them. He had to start again. Now that stone means accurate representation in the material world. So he went back up the mountain, and he spoke to his inner God, and he said, "That was terrible." And God says, "Make him of brass, Moses, make him of brass." Now brass is the metal with a donkey in it, isn't it? And they use brass to make instruments that braid like a donkey, to frighten people. You know, there's nothing more frightening than the sound of a trumpet. And the old name of a trombone is a shake bush or sack boot. Because when people were hiding and didn't want to go to war and the press gangs were looking for them, they used to jump in sacks and tubs, which are butts, you see, and hide in bushes. And they used to get four trombonists and they'd go whoop, and the bushes would go like this, and the bags would go like this, and the tubs would rock. And then they'd say, "Into the army, men." And so the trombone was called that. And trombone means the law of the good. The good law. The trombone. So it means shake them off a bit. They're hiding. Now brass is the ba-ra-as, or the method of breaking the donkey. So when he made them on brass, it means that he was not quite so clear in the formulation as he was beforehand. Because on the tablets of stone, he said, "Why thou shalt have one only God, And he said, why thou shalt honour thy father and thy mother? Why thou shalt not steal? And I said, oh, is that the only reason? See, the thing is, you mustn't explain to a donkey. You must chuff it up a bit. Hence Samson going out and slaying the Philistines with the jawbone of an ass. The jawbone is this. You see, anybody who talks like a twerp is using the jawbone of an ass. So we find out all our politicians slay as many as Samson ever did with the same weapon. The fact is that if you analyse a thing down to its fundamentals, they're essentially dynamic processes at the top level, and they're so abstract and so terribly clear, such as a motion established, unless acted upon by another motion, will carry on being itself. This is self-evident. And the next lower level is to consider them mechanically. That one billiard ball hitting on another billiard ball, if the other billiard ball is not nailed down, will cause it to move. That's slightly lower than the dynamic aspect. Those explanations are so simple, they make people's behaviour change not a bit. So you see that young lad is chasing that girl, and you say to him, are you aware that you're on the Pitriana already and so young? You see, and he goes, And he carries on, it doesn't stop him. There's another method of doing it. You can say to him, you're a queer lad, because when you grow up you won't chase one with bow legs, will you? And he'll say, you've not got bow legs. Oh, hasn't she? Well, you may think they're straight, maybe they're straight to you. Look at the ankle. You see, they go like this, don't they? You ever seen straight ankle? Depends where he focuses his eyes, you see. Now that's making him a brass. There's always a way of saying it when it produces an effect. That's the brass tablets. And there's another way of telling the naked truth. And people go, what's that got to do with me? I don't like clarity.
What would you be using that one for?
Clarity.
When you were giving them the naked truth and they don't want it, what would you be doing to them now?
If you gave them the truth and they didn't want it, you'd just drive them away.
You're just driving them off.
You can do it, actually. If you want them in a room, short of elbow room, you start telling them the truth.
I see that on the other idea, of course, you're directing, aren't you?
Oh,
you're
yes.
Focusing in order to direct.
Yes.
And on the other one, you're just driving away.
Yes. Just like saying to our boys, you know, say, supposing in the next war we have a colossal army of whites and a colossal army of blacks, and we give them medals, and we say to the white ones, the tripe medals we are giving to you are not black tripe, you know. And they say, thank you, sir. Order of the Iron Cross, second class, slightly rusted. Doesn't matter what it is, as long as it's balmy, you know. And looks bigger and better and has a woman at the end of it. Think what you'll tell the girlfriend when you get home. Or think how you'll frat with those larger and unusually blonde girls. And so on. The whole thing, you know, in the army, the first say, where would you like to go? And then they send you somewhere else. You know why?
No.
If you were sent where you wanted to go, you'd feel satisfied, wouldn't you? And you wouldn't want to fight, would you? So they send you somewhere else, and you get very irritated. You're looking for someone to hit. You can't hit your superiors. And every now and then somebody shouts, charge! And you go over and hit them. It's a very good method.
That's a billion ball level, right?
Ha!
integrated this, and people come along and start trying to put those tactics across you, and then they suddenly realise that they're not working, aren't you liable to find yourself in a bit of trouble?
People who know the rules don't try to put them across you if you are working. They'd rather help you. They only put them across people who are not working. These tricks are for working on people that prefer the pitriyama. The moment they prefer to move towards freedom and universal consciousness, they receive help from the people who know, and hindrance from the ones who don't. Because you've got to have somebody helping you and somebody hindering you. No good both types hindering you. You'll get nowhere.
How does this apply in something like a man who attempts to keep out of the army by stating that he's an objector and coming before a court? If his argument is sufficiently sound, he gets help, doesn't he?
Oh, yes, yes. Mm. If his argument is sound and his motive is sound,
yeah,
and his motive determines the soundness of his argument, his real motive, you know.
Mm.
Because if his motive is really pure and he's profoundly ignorant, he will simply say to tricky questions, "I do not understand the question, sir."
Yeah.
If he's got a pure motive. So if his motive is pure, he will not lie, he will not wriggle to establish himself, and therefore he will get help. Even from the judge on the bench, actually.
Mm.
Mm. Who is aware that there are laws that put him where he is. And he doesn't like to go against those laws, you know.
No, you see that with a judge, don't you? As opposed to a lawyer or a barrister who will, if he sees the man to be sincere in his motive,
yeah,
will put the barrister in his place.
Yes.
At the expense.
Oh, yes.
The barrister expense.
Mm. Oh, yes. You see, the thing about a real judge, and English judges are the most real judges in the world, actually, they believe that this law is valid and that their position depends on it. And they believe in this relation between what a man wills and what happens to him. So that they dare not break that universal law themselves.
They know that, but they know.
They know that.
They know that. Mm.
The only time they would give a verdict apparently wrong would be when an innocent man being let off would actually injure the social structure beyond a certain level.
Mm. Like
Christ. Like Christ, Socrates, and in a sense Caesar.
Mm.
Because some things require a price. The development of humanity requires colossal prices. Nothing for nothing, a little for him.
How does a judge go on when he takes up that position? Is he limiting himself, or is he just administering a law in a detached manner?
Well, our best judges do not identify at all with the position that they occupy, which you can see in their humour.
Mm. Mm.
We've had bad judges historically, but the best ones do not identify with the position.
Therefore, they're all right in the job, then.
They're all right.
But the moment they did, then.
Oh, they begin to suffer. And you notice to what lovely ripe old ages they live in. And you can't live that long if you're at war with yourself, you know.
No.
There's self-contradiction going on in your ideas. You're bound to get organic damage.
So those men have to be at a certain level before they can...
Could you be so grossly ignorant in that position that you would be so convinced of your own righteousness, although it be egotism, that you would be without worry?
Well, it's conceivable.
Yeah, I just conceived it, yeah.
It's conceivable. You see, existentially, I don't think one has arrived. and it would require colossal amounts of work before you can reach that dizzy pitch of integrating an egoic centre with truth in it and identifying it to the point of thinking that you generated truth when it is known that truth is eternal. And all we can do in learning about truth is accept the truth that is. We cannot make it.
I wasn't thinking about it quite as the universe is that, as more as in part, in the case of a judge.
I wouldn't think that a high court judge who had reached 70 or more, which some of them do, with a hard job like that, with other men's lives in their hands, could be at such a low level. There'd be too much organic strain in him.
I had in view things like their personal opinions after retiring on sentences such as the death sentence, where they appear to be firmly convinced and even identified themselves with the decision that the death sentence is a necessary sentence.
Well, you see, the death sentence is a necessary sentence at a certain level. It is not necessary for some people.
Well, the fact that it exists.
When a judge is working, what he's doing is integrating ideas. And when he's integrated the ideas up to a certain level, the death sentence is permissible. And he's right as far as he's gone, and he feels right as far as he's gone. Give him some more metaphysical data, and the death sentence becomes wrong, not for other judges, for him. And the reason is that if he gets a criminal under him, that criminal is changed in the way the trial is conducted, and the death sentence is no longer necessary under his hands.
Oh, I see, yes.
That's like if Christ handled a murderer, he could say to him, go and cut nobody's head up again. I forgive you. And the man wouldn't do it. Whereas some other people at such a lower level of integration, that if they let a man off, he would probably do it again. Think, who is that poor halfwit?
Yes. Yeah.
Everything depends on being level.
There are also cases where a trial doesn't appear to get anywhere and they have a retrial with a different judge on it.
Oh, yes, yes. That's again a question of levels. Mm. You see, some people can be satisfied with an inferior judge because they're inferior people. And others appeal to higher courts. And some of the cases, perhaps the defendant may be so astute that he sees loopholes in the whole process and forces it right up into the highest court in the land.
Well, it's the same as we did with George, that the magistrate who he refused to be tried by, who would obviously have found him guilty, was quite upset at being bypassed and refused legal aid.
Yes.
On the grounds that he'd been bypassed by what should have been a cut and dried case.
Well, he felt he was right at his own level.
Yeah.
And for him, he was right.
Yeah.
But he wasn't right. You see, in a few more years' time, he would know that he was wrong. And then when he came up against a similar case, he would handle it differently. And then some historian, if he became big enough, would say that he gave the opposite verdict in the two identical cases with 20 years between. But if you read the history of English judges, you'll find that they have. Diverse judgments like that made at different periods in their life. Both judgments being valid at the integration level in which they stood. You see, this error business depends on your integration level and whether you know consciously certain things or not. If you do not, it is not an error for you. Later, when you understand more about it, that same thing is now an error. If you are not careful, you can feel ashamed of it. But if you understand yourself better, you won't, because you'll say that error was the product of my formal content at that period.
Yes.
Now, I haven't got that formal content, I don't commit that error, so cross it off. That's self-forgiveness. And if your will is such that you will not commit that error again, you should forgive yourself. Because you're wasting energy holding a thing against yourself, which you won't do. Very important to see if you get a man, supposing a man learns a form of square, so you've got a square in him, and he tries a certain case about a man who breaks squares. There's a man that breaks squares, standing in the dock. He's identified in squares,
So he condemns that man for breaking his friends. And a few years afterwards, he's got a triangle in him as well. This time, the same man comes by, and he's been breaking squares again. And he remembers that the last time he sentenced him was because he was breaking squares, and it was the only form he had.
Mm.
So he must hold it, otherwise he loses his security. But now he's got a triangle. So he says, so you've been breaking squares. Haven't you been here before breaking squares? And the boy says, yes. How much did I give you last time? 7 years. Well, this time I'm going to let you off with a severe reprimand. Because you must be loopy to waste your time making inferior objects like squares.
Yeah.
Go for cyclist treatment. And that happens very often. And when he gets another form in, you see, one of these forms, he goes on. This is saturation of form again. He comes to such a pitch that a fellow comes and says, I've just cut my mother-in-law's veins down longitudinally. There's no difference fundamentally between doing that and just, crying or something. All you've done is deprive him of life, and the rest of the thing is entirely in your imagination. What a non-economic man you are. Send him to the School of Commerce for 6 months hard training. That's what he'd say.
Yeah. He'd be relieved of his job.
Wouldn't he now? But when he gets to that level, all the people below him think, he's got a nerve, things he says, and gets away with it.
Yeah.
Because the government likes that sort of thing. Because there's got to be tolerance. Tolerance means rulership, it means tolerance.
Yeah.
You can't rule unless you tolerate. Because if you gave everybody their just deserts, you'd made it a lot of them. And then there'd be no subjects. A king without subjects is no king. You'd be surprised what you can forgive now that you couldn't forgive when you were four.
Adults, for one.
Adults, yes. Grown ups. Those large, stupid things. It was lovely the way they did it. They didn't come from the ground, you know.
Yeah.
They came from behind the car, through just over the roof, and dipped like that. Very good, fellow. It was a salute of the tacit conspiracy.
Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night.